You need to vibrate higher so you can capture the opening of the portal that connects this Earth of 3D to one Earth of 4D or 5D. Going to the 5D.
My name is Phoenix.
I'm Kara.
And we are talking in two dimensions. Good enough.
Good enough.
Fuck it.
That'll work.
Okay, so this is the first episode of our podcast. We're actually doing this, okay? So I want to start this off by introducing ourselves. So Kara, who are you? What do you do, and how exactly did you end up here?
All right, so Kara here. I'm an animation enthusiast, and I really got in here because I guess I annoy people a lot when I say I haven't seen certain movies. So this whole thing is a bit of an experiment to get us to try new things. But besides that, I'm a programmer by trade, and then, of course, on my off time, I'm actually a bit of an illustrator.
Okay. Okay. That's cool. So I'm Phoenix. I suppose I want to start my introduction by saying, oddly enough, movies aren't, you know, my first love. My first love is music. I've been a musician since I was 10 years old. And since then, I have very high standards when it comes to music. But at a certain point, those high standards sort of bled into movies. You know, I started getting exposed to a lot of the internet film critic community, you know, the Red Letter Medias, the YMSs, that sort of thing. And it started exposing me to a ton of new and interesting movies. And it started to, like I said, raise my standards for movies, and eventually, because I had to find a way to get that, just that vomit out of my head and onto paper, I started writing film reviews. And writing film reviews eventually turned into a YouTube channel where I talk about movies, and a YouTube channel where I talk about movies eventually turned into this podcast. So that's how I ended up here. You talked about how you ended up here. So now I guess we're just gonna show you how this podcast works. We each saw a bunch of new movies and we're just now gonna talk about them. So the first movie we are going to talk about is Jurassic World Rebirth, directed by, I believe, Gareth Evans. Let me double check that. I believe I'm right on that. Yes, Gareth Edwards. And basically, this film is more or less a sequel to the Jurassic World movies. A bunch of special ops soldiers go to an island full of dinosaurs to collect samples of dinosaur DNA, and a family also gets involved in this, and there's lots of dinosaurs. We both saw a bunch of dino slop and we were feasting good. Kara, what did you think about this movie?
Actually, leading up to this, I sort of made a note that this is the first Jurassic Park movie out of the newer sort of films that I've
seen. Like the Jurassic World movies.
The Jurassic World movies, yeah. Like, I haven't even seen any of the ones with Chris Pratt. Okay. So this is it. This is my introduction. I sort of came in a little late to the shit show. I had heard from so many people that the new Jurassic movies were not very good. But I actually had no idea. And I can understand it 100%. This is definitely a movie that you can go and see. I feel like it wasn't like awful. It was still pretty entertaining, but there's so many choices that were really baffling.
Yeah.
The family didn't need to be in that movie.
Okay, that's interesting, because I thought the family was the best part of that movie.
Well, I feel like they should have picked either or, maybe, because it's like I don't know. The family I liked more.
Fair. That's where I was going with that. The family are the best part, because in most of those parts, it felt like a horror movie. And when the movie leaned into being a horror movie, it was amusing and entertaining. It wasn't necessarily good, but it was the most effective version of whatever this was could have been. But for some reason, we had to have, fucking Scarlett Johansson, Mahershala Ali being the most generic fucking, soldiers imaginable. Like, they...
with Mr. Stereotypical Nerd Science Man, who loves dinosaurs so much he cried.
There was that scene in the beginning, which, with him crying about how no one comes to the dinosaur exhibit anymore, which was just a thinly veiled subtext of the studios whining about why no one sees these new movies.
That's a good point.
It was so fucking pointed and annoying.
Where? You don't come and see our movies anymore.
Why don't people like these movies? Well, I'll tell you why none of these movies capture what made Jurassic Park so special. Question answered. Shut the fuck up.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel like I'm actually quite excited to get to that point, because I actually haven't seen the original Jurassic Park. Well, I think it's been a long time, I think. Because I believe I've seen at least like the first half, and then something happens and then it's like cut off completely. Like, we get to the part with like the T-Rex that's in the rain, and that's just amazing. And then like, oh yeah, something happens, and I think it was on like a school trip or something.
Okay,
so they're like, oh yeah, no, we made it back to the school, we're turning the movie off. It's like, oh, that's great, thanks.
Lame. Fucking lame. Maybe one day I'll recommend Jurassic Park for this podcast and let you finish that off. But
Jurassic Park and the Land Before Time, Dino episode.
Oh, fuck. Fucking lock that in.
Get ready to cry, boys and girls.
But yeah, back to Dino Slop Rebirth. So, aside from the generic script, like, the special effects in the film could be a bit dodgy. I remember there being a shot when Scarlett Johansson was trying to fire that dart into the swimming dinosaur, and she fell off the boat, and I believe for like a few seconds we saw, like, it had to be one of the worst green screen shots I have seen in quite some time. Like, the background was just so fucking, like, fake. You could clearly tell she was in front of a green screen hanging off something on a wire. It was... oh, when you see shit like that in a film, like, it just rips me right out. And I'm like, okay, we're done here.
I think nothing really stood out in terms of special effects with this film, I think.
Yeah, no, like... all the dinosaurs, I guess, looked fine.
Yeah.
The big, the D-Rex that, the stupid mutant dinosaur.
Yeah.
As I was, leaving the theater, everyone was saying, oh, it looked like, the Xenomorph from Alien. They weren't saying Xenomorph because normies wouldn't actually know the alien from Alien is called a Xenomorph. they were saying, oh, it looks like the alien from Alien. And I'm I'm like, I guess. When I saw it, I thought it looked like a Hell Knight from Doom.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, the head, the face, like, it reminded me of a Hell Knight from Doom. But, oh, okay, back to the writing, because one of the things that bothers me with most big blockbuster movies is just the sheer lack of stakes. Nothing matters, no actions have any real true consequence. This is clearly the case when Mahershala Ali's character makes the, you know, generic noble sacrifice trademark, and then fucking 15 minutes later, oh, he's fine. He survived.
No, he's all right.
Yeah, no, oh, fuck it. You know, you had this big emotional moment and it meant fucking nothing. Okay, thanks. Like,
yeah, I think the worst thing was that they decided to do that in the first place, because either way you end it where he's still dead or he comes back is just a cliche, and it's been done to death, and it's really trying to force emotion. Like, you know, in some movies, especially horror movies, they have like the dog in it, and the dog gets attacked by the ghost or something to elicit a cheap emotion from the audience.
Dogs are like an easy manipulative ploy in a movie, and like it's hard to make a human sacrifice, you know, so cliche and meaningless, but somehow fucking this team of fucking hacks managed to do that. Like, oh my god. This film is fucking, I'm at least happy that the film at least read like they were trying to end the franchise.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they get all the dino DNA, and the scientist and fucking Scarlett Johansson decide to, you know, make their findings, you know, open source, so, like, everyone can use it.
And evil CEO man gets eaten.
Yeah.
His entire character. He has no personality. He's just evil CEO man. You put him in a cartoon, he'd feel right at home.
Yeah, no, he was, generic villain. I like Rupert Friend, you know, he's good in Homeland, you know, at least the three seasons of Homeland that actually are good. Everything after season three is just someone's bad fan fiction, but that's another subject for another time. Anyways, I am at least glad there seems to be an end to fucking
Jurassic sloth
movies. Now, this seemed like the series finale. Like with episode 9 of Star Wars, I feel no compulsion to see any more fucking dino movies.
I'm
done.
I could be completely wrong because of just the very few number of movies that I've seen, but I feel like there's a missing opportunity to just go full throttle into dinosaur horror.
Like we said, you know, that family was, like I said, that family, that Average Joe family was the best part of the film because it leaned into horror. It leaned into a bunch of helpless people trying to avoid giant monsters. And however, you know, ineffective it might have been in the movie as a whole, it was still the best parts of the film. And I would just like to play, picture Alien Isolation, but it's, you know, you're running around trying to hide from a velociraptor or something.
I would want to play that.
So, Jurassic World Rebirth was not good. I suppose if you're a fan of the dino slop, go, you know, it's a fun night out at the theaters. But Otherwise, you could avoid it. And I am feeling a 4.5 out of 10 on this one.
Yeah, I definitely would go with that. I think it really comes down to the fact that it could have been something a little better if they had actually maintained some focus and got rid of some of those cliches.
Yeah.
If they really did just focus on the family that went a little bit too far into the restricted zone and had to survive, it actually might have been a lot better, as opposed to being stretched between them and this secret ops team that was pretty par for the course.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Yeah, so that's Jurassic World Rebirth. Now, we also saw, surprisingly, we both saw the film F1, the movie, because it needed to have the distinction that F1 is the movie, whatever.
Yeah.
this film was directed by Joseph Kaczynski. I'll just pull up my plot description from my review, because I'm lazy, and I'll just read it off, because, again, I'm lazy. So, this film follows a man named Sonny Haynes, a race car driver. Sonny has just won the 24-hour Daytona race and has driven off into the sunset, but an old friend named Ruben, a former rival of Sonny's from his days racing in F1, comes to Sonny with a proposition: join his failing F1 team Apex GP and help him win. Sonny agrees, but as soon as he gets there, he begins butting heads with cocky, young, up-and-coming driver Josh Pierce. With the future of Apex GP hanging in the balance, Sonny must find a way to whip Josh and his team into shape and win the F1 championship. The tone of my reading there pretty much sums up my feelings on the movie. This was mid as fuck.
I definitely feel that. I think the only thing that really stood out for me was that the racing scenes were actually pretty well done.
Yeah.
The racing actually had a lot of energy. Like, you could feel the speed in the cars and so on. There was a lot of tension there. I really liked it. But outside of the racing, it was just kind of mediocre, I suppose, yeah.
This director knew where the bread was buttered. The bread was buttered with the car racing. Like, they shot at actual F1 events over the course of a couple of years. There was some really good stunt coordination, you know, stunt driving. It was really well done. Those sequences were well presented, well edited. They were entertaining, but again, there's more to a movie than the cars going vroom vroom, you know?
Yeah, and it's actually kind of a shame that, yeah, that's most of what you can talk about, is that the car side of it was just really, really good. And the dedication to filming that is admirable, but
yeah.
No, I just felt that the plot was just sort of eh. Like, I feel like if you are a big fan of F1, then it's definitely still worth kind of seeing, at least for the car aspect of it. But you're not going to get moved by these characters,
no,
really.
No, really. It's the most cookie-cutter fucking sports film imaginable. Like, I was calling plot beats, like, well before they were going to happen. You know, it's a shame because the character of Sonny Haynes is actually kind of interesting. Like, you could actually easily write a movie around that guy. You could easily tell a story about a guy with a death wish, because this character clearly had a death wish. Why write a movie with stakes? Why write a movie with, you know, interesting, you know, character development and an interesting character arc, you know? Fucking instead we get fucking Sonny Haynes winning the F1 championship, you know, getting the girl and then driving off into the sunset, you know, everyone gets their wishes, la-di-da-di-da, fucking gumdrops and rainbows. Fuck consequences, you know?
Yeah, he actually just goes back to doing exactly what he was before. Just sort of embracing the at these small little tournaments for money, yeah. just being on the road and stuff like that. I don't really know what lesson he was supposed to learn. I sort of, through the film, it seemed like it's like, oh, yeah, sometimes when you're reckless, you take people with you. Like, but I don't actually know if he learns that lesson, except for when the up-and-comer crashes.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he... I think the script essentially just went with the generic. He had unfinished business with Formula One, but, you know, he's old, he's over the hill, can he do it? You know, the typical sort of comeback story, but again, you know, I've seen that before, you know, freaking Rocky VI is a better version of this, and that's a different sport. But, yeah. F1 is, you know, if you like Formula One, you know, because at least the writers seem to give a shit about the sport.
Yeah.
And how it was presented. So if you like Formula One, I guess you'll get some value out of this. But again, there's more to movies than cars going vroom vroom.
That's very true. That's very, very true.
Yeah, no, and I am feeling a 5 out of 10 on this one.
Yeah, I'd say it's a little bit better than Jurassic World for sure. Yeah. It definitely has more substance. I'd agree with a bit of 5, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we also, moving on from F1, we also saw the film Superman. Saw James Gunn's new Superman film, the first entry into James Gunn's DC Universe. And in this film, Superman is trying to stop Lex Luthor from taking over a fucking Middle Eastern country, and he's sort of dealing with his own personal issues as well. And yeah, Kara, what did you think of Superman?
I think this is the one I was most excited to talk about. Yeah. I actually, I thoroughly enjoyed the new Superman. I was hoping leading up to the film that he would go back to the sort of traditional Boy Scout, country bumpkin Superman, and that's definitely what we got, as opposed to metaphor for Jesus or something like that. Like, you know, need some antidepressants, Superman. I thought all around this was actually a really fun movie to watch. The humor was good. The action was good. I'd say in terms of DC turning things around, hopefully for their cinematic universe, I'd say it's a really good start, actually. It's a very solid step forward.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked Superman quite a bit. It was refreshing to see a Superman movie where Superman was actually acting like fucking Superman.
Yeah. And I suppose the other thing, too, is it's nice to have a superhero movie, or at least like a movie in general, with color. The color in this movie is very, very vibrant. I love Superman's costume. Yeah. It's so refreshing. Also, in that side of things, Marvel's trying to catch up with that idea, too, with Fantastic Four. That one actually has quite a lot of color to it as well. True. But it's good to see color come back.
Yeah, no. And that's partially because James Gunn is, you know, an actual honest-to-God director, and he has a good understanding of what these superhero movies are, and he has a good understanding of what tone they should take on, and he is very good at balancing that tone, and James Gunn is also very good at handling big budgets. Because, you know, I'm not going to lie, this film is, you know, on par with any other fucking CGI clusterfuck that's out there. But James Gunn the action in this movie had a good flow to it, and it wasn't visually nauseating. Like, I could tell what was going on, and none of the computer effects ripped me out of the film. And you were talking about Superman's costume. Like, yeah, it's very nice. It's very colorful. Guy Gardner's costume as well looked very good.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Mr. Terrific is a very unique looking superhero.
Yeah, I'd actually had never heard of him until this movie came out. But I gotta say, he was definitely one of my favorite parts. Yeah. The humor that came from his character and, like, his sort of side plot with Lois was really, really good.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed that.
Because that falls into James Gunn's writing strengths. James Gunn knows how to write, you know, ragtag weirdos and assholes, you know, teaming up and trying to bumble their way into accomplishing a goal. And... because the Justice Gang, which is a working name for them, they're the Guardians of the Galaxy, essentially.
Oh yeah, like absolutely, yeah, yeah. They've got that same sort of vibe. They're still like different characters for sure, but they still got that same.
Oh, absolutely, vibe. Absolutely, yeah. And that also isn't to say that James Gunn didn't understand how to write Superman, because I'm not gonna lie, James Gunn wasn't my first pick to do Superman, but James Gunn understands what Superman is, surprisingly enough, and he really nailed it. Like, Superman's character arc in this film was very, very endearing, yeah. And it captured the best parts of that character from the comics, I feel.
No, I think so too, and I also appreciate how we just got right into the action. Like, we already know Superman's backstory. It's very clear at this point. And I appreciate that we just jumped right into it. Like, we know where he comes from, we know who he is. Let's just get into the plot. Let's skip to Superman. So that was awesome as well, because it feels like every time Superman is rebooted, we always go back to, you know.
Yeah, that happens with most superhero franchise reboots. We have to redo the origin story, but with this, it just threw you to the wolves. You know, we got a text blurb, you know, explaining the state of the universe.
Yeah, just in case.
At that given time, but still, it didn't explain, you know, it didn't explain who Superman was or what his relationships were to people. You were just allowed to glean that from the scenes that were provided, and it's both a godsend and a shame that I have to praise, you know, a writer and a director for treating the audience like they have a brain, because so many, you know, modern fucking blockbusters, especially in the wake of the MCU and all these studios, and in these studios' desperate chase to try and replicate that success, they have to, you know, fucking explain and spoon-feed everything to an audience. No, James Gunn, again, just threw you to the wolves, and it was so fucking refreshing that I didn't have to sit through a 20-minute fucking origin story. It's great.
Oh, no, it's so much better. And especially it helps with the pacing as well, because, like, if you just get right into it, you have so much more time to dedicate to this full-on, like, the major plot of the story.
Yeah. Yeah, no. And that major plot of the story is, you know, on one level, we have, you know, Lex Luthor being a cartoon villain, you know.
Oh, but it's so good.
Oh, right.
It's so good. He is such a he's such a fucking hater.
Yeah.
I loved him for it. It's definitely this was a good Lex, I think.
Yeah, no, Nicholas Holt was so good as Lex Luthor. Apparently, you know, apparently Nick Holt auditioned for Superman but lost out to David Corenswet. So apparently he was just, he was channeling that real salt.
There we go. That's, and you know what? That's perfect.
Yeah.
I genuinely love how much of a hater Lex Luthor is in this movie.
And when I said he's a cartoon villain, that isn't derogatory. Like, I love, you know, nyuk-nyuk cartoon villains. You know, he's trying to take over, you know, a country and, you know, rule it like his own personal kingdom.
He wants to be a king, yes.
Yeah, no,
is what the movie says. He wants to be a king of his own country.
That's very fun. And, you know, and then I guess on another level, it is touching on real world things. It is touching on Russia and Ukraine, you know, Israel and Palestine. It didn't feel, you know, preachy or sanctimonious about it, at least.
Yeah, no, I didn't get
it's
that
very,
either.
Yeah, no, there, because in order to, you know, for Lex Luthor to be, you know, King Yuck Yuck, he has to stoke. Yeah. He has to stoke the fires between fucking whatever Istan and fucking Boravia, I think the country's called.
Something like that for sure.
Yeah, I don't.
I do believe that those countries are from the comics, though, as well.
Yeah, fair.
So they are. They do actually exist in the comics.
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't read too many comics, even though you're sitting behind a giant stack of fucking comic books. Like, I don't read many, don't read too much, but, like, it's, like, the words, at least, like I said, it isn't preachy or sanctimonious about it. It's just a fun action story, and if you do notice that it is bringing in those real world ideas and elements, it is easy to digest, and you can glean that for yourself. And what's also so cool is that, you know, it does handle Superman's existence in a geopolitical landscape well enough, because, you know, we had that whole scene of Lois, you know, grilling Superman about, you know, you entered a country's airspace, you know, without congressional approval, and, you know, assaulted a world leader.
Yeah.
You know, you caused a shit show. Like, how do you deal with that? And, you know, like, in the real world, like, what would we do if fucking, you know, Kal-El ended up in fucking real life fucking Kansas and was saving people in Chicago?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Like, it presents issues, and I'm always glad when superhero stories at least
don't live in a bubble.
Yeah. And at least try to, you know, accept that, you know, there are real world consequences. There would be very big consequences to someone with that much power living amongst humanity. Like, it's the same reason I really like Invincible, because that show handles the consequences of being a superhero really, really well. I'm sure at some point we will talk about Invincible in more depth, but, you know.
Oh yeah, we'll definitely get to that as well. I do believe at some point we want to do some episodes dedicated to TV shows.
Yes, we will eventually do very long form TV series, and, you know, at one point we will talk about Invincible if that show ends. So yeah, another thing I really, really liked about Superman was the music.
Oh,
yeah. The score is very good. It reminds me a ton of the John Williams score from, you know, the 78, 79, I think.
I do believe it's 78.
the 78 Superman. The composers for this film, though, they weren't ripping off John Williams. It felt more like a reverent homage to that sort of score. That main motif, that main Superman theme for this film, it felt like, you know, that da 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 da. You know, it felt like that, but it had its own musical palette. It had its own interesting arrangement, and it's still, and on its own, it felt triumphant, it felt powerful, and it was used really well during that scene where Boravia was invading the Fuckistan or whatever it's called, and the kid was raising the Superman flag.
Oh, that was, and that, like, was, yeah.
The synths come in lightly playing that main melody, and then when, like, Superman sort of flies into Metropolis and I think saves a girl from getting crushed by a building, you know, the horns, the whole shebang come in, and it just feels so big, like so monumental. Like, it's well used music, well composed. I was surprised, because James Gunn's films, at least the Guardians of the Galaxy films, are known for their, like, playlist soundtrack. Superman didn't have much licensed music in it.
No, not any that really sticks out.
No,
to
I,
me.
I
no,
think
no, it's definitely a bit of a change from the Guardians of the Galaxy, which really had that sort of tie-in to, like, the 70s, 80s in terms of its music.
Yeah, for sure. There was a licensed song during the credits, but that was pretty much it. It was all, or at least most of it, was, like, original score. Like, well-composed, you know, action music.
Yeah.
And it's just so refreshing to have a Superman movie feel, you know, big and fun and exciting after 10 fucking years of Zack fucking Snyder ruining superhero movies.
No, and it just, I feel like the reason why Superman in particular is so refreshing, because it feels good to watch. You feel good after watching that movie, you know? Like, it's really uplifting. It's not, like, so dark and depressing. Like, it has its moments, but it's just, like, you feel, like, a sense of, like, hope after the movie is done. It's great.
Yeah, no, I am left intrigued and interested in the DCU going forward. This was a good omen that maybe the rest of these movies won't be terrible. You know, I can't.
Edgelord, Batman, post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, no, it's just, yeah, it won't turn into Batman v Superman or, you know,
Martha,
or fucking, why did you say that name?
Why did you say that? I can't believe I remembered that, by the way.
Fuck.
I don't remember the rest of that movie except for that part.
I haven't. I don't think I've seen it since I saw it at the theaters, and that was 10 years ago.
Oh my gosh, time flies. It's, yeah, and we don't even want to talk about that Lex Luthor at all. Like, this, that one was,
yeah,
probably at some point when we get to that, we can poke fun at it, maybe compare and contrast to our new Superman movie.
Yeah, I think after Superman, the second season of Peacemaker is coming out.
I liked August. His cameo. His cameo was really good. That was really funny. Yep.
Yeah, no, John Cena's such a great comedic actor.
Oh, like, gosh,
yeah. Because he's so,
it's the charisma.
Yeah, he's
it's the
charisma.
And, the
and because he was a professional wrestler for so long, he's very giving. Like, he will no matter what the material is, he will give it 100% and try to get it over. And, you know, even if it's for just a quick bit, like in this film where he's on a talk show ragging on Superman.
Oh, like, yeah. That's... How can a hero do something like that?
Oh, yeah, says the noted murderer. Like, but, you know, God. It's... Well, also, yeah, no, the cast in this film was quite good.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
we mentioned Nicholas Holt as Lex Luthor. He was great. He especially so in that final scene where he went from, you know, just douchey businessman to like sniveling fucking, you know, cuck male. Like, why are you so good, Superman? Why don't people like me?
Yeah, that was pretty good. But also, just like, he's just like, no, this whole conflict, you know, this conflict is just a part of it. My whole plan has always been to get rid of you. This was just a convenience, this fight. In all of my goals, everything has been to get rid of you. And it's just, again, that hater energy, so good. And and the scene where he's drinking out of his coffee, you know, after Superman like throws the table because he's wondering, he's demanding to know where Krypto is.
Yeah.
And he's just like sniveling into his cup a little bit to sort of rag him on a little bit more.
It's so good. And might as well move on. David Corenswet as Superman, he was potentially better than Henry Cavill. It's just a shame Henry Cavill didn't have any better material.
I know, because he is with.
Yeah, but like, I guess by virtue of the fact that Henry Cavill was Superman in a bunch of shitty movies, David Corenswet wins out.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, no, he's arguably better than Henry Cavill. I might dare to say he might be equal to Christopher Reeve.
Yeah, we're getting into that territory. I'd still say that out of all the Supermans, Christopher Reeve is still my favorite.
Yeah.
But he's like a close second. Like, yeah. I really think he did a fantastic job.
Everything Corenswet did, everything he said it with like such earnestness, such conviction. He was charming, you know,
and such a goofball.
Yeah, he was a goofball. Yeah, he was a dork, and you know, Superman's a dork again. It's so refreshing have a Superman movie where Superman acts like fucking Superman.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I mean,
all the people in the Justice Gang were great. Fucking Nathan Fillion was so good as Guy Gardner.
In his element.
Yeah.
That guy is so good. Such a funny actor. He's incredible in so many other things. He was great. He did very well for that part. The comedy, the sort of the timing, the cockiness, the unwarranted ego, you know, awesome.
Yeah, no, he's fun. I was unfamiliar with this version of the Green Lantern. Again, I don't read many comics, but I'm interested in finding some comics with this character in it.
Nathan
Fillion really sold me on him. He's good.
Apparently, actually, on that topic, he pushed for that hairstyle, too, actually. He was like, no, we're going to do the dopey bowl cut hairstyle.
Nice.
Like, there's no way I'm doing this character without the hairstyle, or at least that's what I heard online. And honestly, if that's true, like, power to him. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Because that was definitely, I feel like, one of the highlights of his character.
Oh my god. Edie Gathegi, I think that's how you say his name. He was very good as Mr. Terrific.
Oh yeah.
He was entertaining. He was able to deliver the deadpan, you know, monotone genius level sort of dialogue, but there was always like comedic underpinning.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
When he showed more personality, it always felt, you know, like an earned leap.
Shocked or
yeah. Yeah, no, it was great. Rachel Brosnahan, the girl that played Lois Lane, I guess she was good.
Yeah.
At least she had more to do than whoever played Lois Lane in, like, Man of Steel or Batman v Superman. I forget.
Yeah, I like how she's actually... Her side plot contributes a lot to the end of the movie. Like, if it wasn't for her doing her investigative journalism, finding out all of these things with her, you know, her coworkers, like, she had a very important role, and I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, that's... it's so good. Metamorpho, Anthony Carrigan, in that role, he was very good. Like, he gave, like, a genuinely... emotional, riveting performance during those scenes in, like, that pocket universe prison.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was...
I felt so sorry for that character. That's awful.
Yeah, no, and again, those emotions, those stakes, they were at least in some way earned. You know, unlike the movies we were talking about earlier, you know, things felt, you know, warranted.
Yeah, they did feel warranted. It felt like there was... some risks involved, you know, and especially as the stakes got progressively bigger and bigger and bigger, because it goes from a war to an actual black hole splitting the earth in half.
Yeah.
Like, it just escalates and escalates and escalates because Luthor doesn't know when to stop. He keeps going. Whenever Superman has a success, he'll go 10 times bigger with his sort of getting back at him.
Yeah, no, this this film is just good. Yeah. It's just a good movie. And I think if you're a fan of the Cape shit, you should
absolutely
see this in a theater if it's still running. Just see it when you can. It's good, and I look forward to seeing the other DCU films, and I hope James Gunn can maintain the momentum. Good for him. I'm feeling an 8 out of 10 on Superman. It's good.
Yeah, 8 out of 10. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
All right.
So, all right. Pretty matched with a lot of our movies that we've seen recently, at least.
Yeah, no. It's interesting. We seem to agree on things so far. Let's now get into the recommended movies. So, every episode going forward will have sort of a theme to it, but for this first episode, we're just gonna talk about two random movies just to show you how things work.
Exactly.
One's gonna be, you know, animated or, you know, close to animated in certain cases, and mine is gonna be, like, primarily live action. Certain times we may deviate from the script, you know, a little, but generally this is what it's gonna be. And the first film we are going to talk about is the film... Notes.
Our first film for today is 2007's Surf's Up.
Yes, directed by Diddly Diddly Doo. Let me pull up my letterbox.
Directors Ash Brannon and Chris Buck.
Yes. What is Surf's Up all about?
All right, so our 2007 film essentially is a mockumentary-style animated film that follows Cody, our titular sort of rock hopper penguin who lives in the Antarctic and he really wants to become a surfing champion after a well-known celebrity, Big Z, shows up to his island. He ends up going to Penghu Island to participate in essentially a world tournament for surfing. Eventually, he meets this bum individual named Zeke, who sort of slowly teaches him the way of surfing and so on. This one... I suppose I'll probably separate this into topics a bit. When it comes to animation, you're going to hear a lot of things about character design, animation techniques, and so on. Anything along those lines, any cool facts that I can sort of come up with, or well, not come up with, but find, I suppose. There's a few with this one, not too many. But yeah, I guess first off, I'd say the first thing that comes to mind with this one is it actually didn't age too bad.
Yes. Yeah, no. I hadn't seen this for well over a decade at least. And after rewatching it, I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, same, actually. Yeah,
no, it was very... It was different for an animated film, at least around this time. I really think the presentation of the film was one of the things that carried it. As you said, it's done in a mockumentary style, so Cody is being followed around by a film crew.
A crew, yeah, exactly.
You know, and a lot of the cinematography feels, you know, handheld, shaky, and that's because a lot of it is apparently, because apparently they had a bunch of people in green screen suits carrying around cameras mimicking the movement of a film crew, more or less.
Yeah,
and
so
the animators sort of just animated around that.
Essentially how it worked was they were able to develop this technology that allowed them to move the cameras in the animated world as if they were filming a documentary. So to anyone who might find this familiar, this is what the Lion King live action would sort of herald as the thing, the new technology that came up with. But this was actually originally made in 2007 for this film. So they could actually move these cameras in the real world to give them that shake and that sort of genuine feel of a crew. I think the other really nice touch is every once in a while there's like a boom mic that gets in the shot. Yeah. and things like that. There's little things as well that really tie it together.
Yeah, no, it really... It recreates the documentary style of filmmaking very well. I love... One of the things that I liked was the editing in the film. Like, it was edited in a manner that really felt like a documentary. It reminded me at many points of a show like The Office or Parks and Recreation.
Yeah.
Like, there was a bit, like, I think in the first act, Cody wipes out on a big wave, and during which time he gets stung by a...
Oh, yes,
sea,
a red
sea
urchin. Yeah, yeah.
And I think at some point one of the characters were talking about the sea urchin and how yeah. it stung him, and then it cuts to an interview with that sea urchin.
Stepped on me. He danced on me.
Yeah.
This one's broken. This one. This one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That's
yeah,
pretty
no,
good.
Yeah. No, that felt like a bit from The Office.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think the other thing as well is that just before that, I also love how they just keep playing his wipeout over and over again.
That was
great.
No.
That's a nice touch as well. Like that's so on. Point for a lot of like sports channels and things
yeah,
like
no.
that. No, yeah. They really put their all into making this feel as realistic as possible in an animated world, and I think that's definitely one of the highlights of the film for sure.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of filmmaking, the only one of the things that I guess before we get into that with the animated films I've been watching for this podcast, one of the things I've taken notice of is water animation in
these
films.
Effects.
I like a good water effect, and in this film there's some really nice looking water.
Oh
some,
yeah, the water looks really good.
I loved the final shot where Cody and Z were just riding a wave. And, like, the sun was reflecting off the water. It looked really sleek. For 2007, at least back then, it's, like you said, it's aged pretty damn well. It looks good still.
Oh, yeah, it looks really good. I feel like you can sort of see the evolution of animation or 3D animation through the water effects.
Yeah.
As we've progressed through and made animation better, you can sort of see that in how we're able to animate water. Like, if you were to compare this to, say, Moana, you could really see that sort of change over time. Yeah. But yeah, for back then, the water looks really, really good. That final scene is actually definitely one of my favorites, where everyone just sort of picks up their boards and just has a good time.
Yeah.
And it's got a good soundtrack.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I'll definitely leave that to my music co-host.
Yeah, no, I'm...
But like I enjoyed it for sure. I thought it was very, very... I can at least say... For sort of like the punkish character that Cody is, and sort of the vibe of the movie that they're going for, the soundtrack, the songs they picked are really, really good.
And I would say when the soundtrack worked, it worked.
Oh, yeah.
I had issues with some of the songs they picked. The start of the movie, it started with Holiday. And, like, don't get me wrong, I like Green Day. American Idiot's one of my favorite records. Like, yeah, she's staring at my giant fucking Green Day poster yeah. right behind me.
She's like, oh, you don't say. You're a big fan. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Like, but good God, that was a shitty song choice for that scene.
Oh, yeah. No, that was a little jarring,
at least. Gee, it was such a shitty song choice that they cut the vocals out of the song.
Yeah, they didn't
add the instrumental. Yeah. Almost like that song was lyrically incongruous to the scene. Because that song is an anti-war anthem.
Oh, but, shit. Okay, there we go. That's...
You know, like, if... They made up for it later, because they used Welcome to Paradise, which at least lyrically fit the...
Yeah.
When they were all arriving at fucking Penghu Island... That at least fit the scene, but that earlier scene, if you were desperate to use a Green Day song, there are other songs you could have used. I think probably Burnout would have worked better. Like, that's just off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But also... During the scene where fucking Chicken Joe was getting, like, roasted alive by...
Oh, the penguins.
By
natives.
The fucking indigenous penguins. It was... They used What I Like About You by the Romantics, and, like... it wasn't incongruous to the scene, but it just felt like a lazy... hacky song choice because it's such a ubiquitous fucking radio hit.
Oh, yeah.
But the rest of the... Generally, the rest of the music was fine. You know, it generally fit the beach, you know, vibe the film was going for. There was, like, some chill Incubus music, a bunch of other stuff. There was... This is the other problem I have with the soundtrack. There could have been more surf rock. They used
that's a good point.
They used Wipeout, which they used a version of the song Wipeout, which is like, okay, that's cool. That fit the particular scene that was in. It was when the lifeguard and Cody were sledding around in a cave.
Oh, yeah, him and the girl.
Lonnie, I think her name was.
I think so. Let me double check. Yeah, Lonnie. Yeah. Lonnie was her name.
Yeah. That worked, but, like, I could have used a little more, you know, fucking, you had a fucking, you were doing a movie about surfers, and there was no Dick Dale. Fucking, you, Miser Lou was right there, you know. You know that. The music from Pulp Fiction. Like, it was right there. Why didn't you use it? Like, come on, more surf rock.
I will at least give Surf's Up this, is that I've definitely heard more egregious pop song sort of picks for movies. Like, This was all right. Definitely know a lot more about these things than I do, but I felt just as like a, I guess, being very casual with I suppose the soundtrack. I thought it was all right. I thought it was pretty good. And yeah, because I've heard way worse. I have heard some absolute, like, you just put it in here because it's a popular song, like,
yeah, no.
Uptown Funk in the new Lilo and Stitch. I heard about that, even though that song actually hasn't been popular for
a long time now. That was a hit over, like, 10 years ago?
Yeah, holy, like 2015,
shit.
16.
Shit.
It's just like, wow, you just put this in here because
It's a popular song. Yeah.
Like, I at least feel like with this one, they tried to at least keep the theming in check for the most part. That said, now that we've sort of given some time to the soundtrack, character design? I really like the character designs in this movie. I think they're very successful. I sort of, at the very beginning of the movie, I absolutely love the jab at Happy Feet, which has some of the worst female animal designs I've ever seen, but I'll save my criticisms of that film for when we eventually get to it. Because this came out a year after Happy Feet. Which I had to check because I had such a, I had a laugh at the beginning where they're like, oh, like, do you like sing and dance? And he's like, do we sing and dance? No, we don't do any of that. And I'm like, hold on. Oh yeah, that is a jab at Happy Feet. Because in terms of a penguin movie, this is far more successful. Yeah. I like Cody's design. I like how they decided to base him off of a rock hopper, because out of all the penguins, they are definitely, I'd say, the most punk rock with those yellow feathers. They did sort of get the habitat and things like that wrong. But it's just a silly comedy movie. I'm not going to hold it against that, because it's at that point, it's just like, well, hear the CinemaSins ding in the background or whatever. It's just like, no, they picked it because it's a cool looking penguin and we're following like a punky teenager who really likes surfing. And that's a really cool pick. And it really sort of differentiates him from the rest of the penguins as well, because the rest of them seem to be based off mostly off of kings and emperors that don't have the crest.
Yeah.
I really like how a lot of them, they sort of took advantage of the difference between the white and the black. So some of them have a pattern kind of on, like, around out of the black part of their sort of feathers. Like Big Z or Zeke, he's got flowers. I think hibiscus flowers on him. Mm. Like, he's got, like, native sort of Hawaiian flowers on him to sort of touch on his sort of more chill, like, personality. You have, of course, Cody, who kind of has, like, a sharper look to it, but not terribly defined. And then, of course, I feel like one of the best parts of this movie, Tank.
Yes.
he is covered in tribal tattoos, and that is so good. That is just such a great look. I love how he's just covered in these tribal tattoos. It speaks, like, you immediately know what his character is about as soon as you look at him.
You pretty much stole the words right out of my mouth, Kara. The character designs in this film, like, you know, because they're all fucking, generally they're all mostly penguins, and you know, you could easily fall into the trap of them just looking the same, but
Happy Feet.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, everyone, all the characters in this film had a distinct look to them, and you could easily differentiate between who these characters are, what they look like, you know, what their personality is, and like you said, I love Tank's design, all the tribal tats. Like, he's such a fun douche.
He's
a fun villain.
Oh, he's such a fun villain. And the scene with him showing off his trophies
That's good.
So good. So, so good.
That's fun.
They really nailed his character down. And the design really emphasizes that. He is such a douchebag. But it's like, in a way, like, he's really good at surfing, but otherwise is just so incompetent.
Yeah.
He's such an idiot.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, characters and writing, I think the other thing that carries the film are the characters. In terms of just structural writing and story stuff, it isn't, you know, amazing. It's a sports film. It's a kid's film. It has all the sort of tropey stuff that comes in with these sorts of movies, like, we have the, you know, main characters falling out moment, like,
oh yeah,
that happens exactly. In like the fucking second and third, between the second and third act, that's real fucking riveting stuff. But truly, the characters, from a writing perspective, also have so much personality that it kind of makes up for, like,
the cliches.
The cliches. And the structural tropiness of it all. And that's helped by the voice cast.
Oh, the voice cast. The voice cast is so good.
Shia LaBeouf, actual cannibal Shia LaBeouf.
Yeah, plays our main character, Cody, and amazing fit. Yeah. His voice is perfect for the role. He gets that sort of stubborn, like, go-go-go kind of, like, young teenager.
Absolutely. He was so natural. He sounded so natural and so charming in the role. There was a particular bit I liked, both from a writing and a performance standpoint. It was just after the fucking, you know, hacky main characters falling out moment. And, like, the camera people are following Cody, and Cody says, like, something along the lines of, you know, I already lost one father, you know, here we go again, something like that.
Yeah, and then...
And that sort of just makes up for how tropey and cliched that moment is, because that moment...
was kind of touching.
It was touching, and it was such a subtle little glimpse into that character and his genuine feelings, and it was also performed very... for a film like this, it was performed very well.
Yeah, like, I also sort of love the fact that he cuts himself off and then he just shoots the cameras away. He's like, no, just whatever. Just, I didn't say anything, whatever. Just go away, leave me alone.
Yeah, no, that, also, fucking Jeff Bridges as Big Z. Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He's just playing the dude. He's just being the dude. No, that works for me.
It works. It works. And I really love the scenes between Zeke and Cody, actually.
Yeah.
I love the difference in their personality, because, like, Zeke is just sort of like this guy who, he fell out of surfing because he lost his love for the sport because it just became too competitive. And then when Cody comes around and sort of talks him into it, he sort of gets that love back a little bit. But he's a lot more patient and easygoing. Like, yeah. I feel like a really good point that sort of exemplifies them as characters is when they're making the board, because, like, Cody just wants it, like, out. He wants it built, like, right now. And then Zeke is just like, oh, you know, you take this and you go with the grain, and you gotta take your time. You gotta carve, the board is in there. You gotta carve it out. You gotta bring out the board.
Yeah, you know, the themes of the film aren't, you know, exactly complex or, you know, thought provoking. You know, you do it, you know, you play the sport, you do the thing because you love it.
And yeah.
That's why you have to do it. You know, but again, it's the characters carry this entire thing, and they make those themes really resonate. Speaking of characters, Diedrich Baker plays Tank.
Yeah.
And he was entertaining. I think maybe there are other actors that could have gotten more out of that particular character, but considering what he was doing, he was very good. He was entertaining.
Oh, yeah, very entertaining. Yeah, I just, like, I love the scenes where he's doing the interviews. Like, he just, like, eats up the attention that he's getting.
Yeah.
Like, he just thinks he's hot shit, but he's such a piece of crap. All the characters drive it pretty well. I think also, even like Chicken Joe is pretty great.
Yeah, John Heater.
Yeah, because he just, I love how his humor compared to like some of the rest of the film, which there's a lot of potty humor. Like, I think that's the only thing that sort of like kind of brings it down for me is like, because the first half of the movie is fine and then they just flood it in. Like, they're trying to sort of compensate for the fact they didn't have like a fart joke within the first 30 minutes. But yeah, like Chicken Joe, all the humor comes from the fact that he's just a chill dude.
Yeah, no.
He doesn't care. Like, he makes friends with like the natives on accident because they're trying to cook him, right? But then he's like, oh yeah, you guys got to have one of these. And he pulls out like the squid sticks, like the fried squid. And then they just start following him everywhere. Yeah. And it's great. And on the topic of Chicken Joe, actually, there's one thing I'll commend this movie for. And it's that Cody doesn't win.
Yes.
Cody actually does not win. It's Chicken Joe that ends up actually winning the competition. And I think it's kind of brave for the movie to do that. And like, our main character learns his lesson.
I wouldn't call it brave because that's just the ending of Rocky. But
I suppose. I guess it's just like, I've been so used to characters getting everything that they want by the end of the movie, and how sort of like some of the previous movies we were talking about previous, just sort of like all the edge and things stand it off. It's like, it's kind of refreshing to be like, you know, he didn't need to win this whole time. He just needed to learn to love the sport, and did.
There was actual, you know, consequence to it. Like you're saying, Chicken Joe was very entertaining. He was it's just a big pothead. He's sort of bumbling about.
And if you pay close attention to his scenes, I swear, two cameramen die.
Yeah, no.
like there are just, like, there's just actually casualties in this movie.
Yeah, no. a couple cameramen get some spears to the chest. That was entertaining.
That was pretty entertaining. It's great.
One of the performances that I think the performance that I enjoyed, and it's a sleeper one, was James Woods as the otter.
Yeah.
Like, he was just being James Woods, but good God, he ate that script up.
Oh,
like,
he did.
Was so funny.
We need to give this man more voice acting jobs, because, my God, when he's voice acting, he does such a great job. Like, Hades? Oh,
yeah, James
man.
Woods is so good.
So,
love James
so
Woods.
So good. Cause like, I think eventually we'll probably do this as a long form video, but I sort of have my opinions on how a lot of animated films anymore, they pick just famous people, but there really is a skill to voice acting, and not all actors have it.
Eventually I think we will do like actor spotlights to really show how certain actors handle, you know, live action and voice performances. But James Woods, in most roles he does, he just eats up the script. He is such a presence.
He's
so entertaining.
No, he's got to be, what, like, him and like Jeremy Irons have got to be some of my favorite voices when it comes to like villains and whatnot. He did great. Like, I couldn't help but laughing at like this cartoonishly like awful sort of like recruiter exec kind of character. Yeah. Like, I love how, like, you know, it's near the end of the movie and they think Cody's dead and they're like, wait, don't touch the board. It's gonna be a memorial for the young surfer who tried. And he speaks such a dick, and he's trying to make it into a marketing thing, but it's like, this dude could have been shredded by a bunch of rocks.
And then, you know, Cody and Z turn out to be fine.
Yeah.
And then everyone just goes off to surf, and I think at the end someone pulls off the otter's rug.
Oh yeah, his wig. Yeah, toupee thing. It's his little assistant, the little
the little bird.
Deer kill, I think. I'm actually not sure what species of bird it is. That's the closest that I can think of. Yeah. But the assistant is really, really funny, too.
Yeah, true.
I really like the humor from the assistant. The couple of lines that they have are really, really funny. I feel so bad for them.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, again, this was... I think in terms of animated movies from the 2000s, this felt, despite maybe not being that different from the pack in terms of storytelling and writing, in terms of presentation and characters and acting, this was refreshing.
Yeah, like, I think the only thing with this movie besides the cliches that holds it back for me is the insane amount of potty humor, like, because some of those jokes just fall flat. They fall flat so bad, because it's just like, you just added a fart here because you felt like you needed to tick something off of a chart or whatever. And I feel like that is such... You can tell you're getting a movie from, like, the early 2000s when there's just that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
When you put those things aside... I'd say it's a pretty competent film. It's not anything, you know, it's not like an Emmy award-winning crazy, but for what they did, it's very competent. The editing is good, the character designs are good, the voice acting is good. I definitely feel like this is sort of like a fun movie that you can put on. Like, I'm not going to say, like, oh, you got to rush to go see this. It's like...
It'd be good for, like, family movie night.
Very good for family movie night. Or if you're around my, like, our age, and you probably saw this movie when you were really young, I'd say, you know what, go back, see what you think about it. But it's not like I'm telling you to, like, clamor over everything and rent it on Amazon. It's like, you got to go see this now. It's like, no. If you're bored one night, you can definitely put this on and have a pretty good time. Like, it's a decent film.
Yeah, no. Before we wrap this particular discussion up, Zooey Deschanel played the girl character, Lonnie, or whatever. She was fine.
Oh, yeah, she was fine. Good. She did pretty good.
Her and
Cody
Shia LaBeouf, they had decent chemistry. They were cute.
Yeah, they were pretty cute.
But she, compared to the other performances, I guess she didn't really stand out
really. Like, she had some funny moments, but, like, I feel like her personality is so much more down, like
to average. Earth
and average. Like, she's just more relaxed than the very colorful personalities that surround her, like the Tank.
Or Big Z. Or Big Z. Or Cody.
Or, you know.
I did like the gag of her constantly having to save that little fat penguin.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Yeah. That's pretty good. Ah, I turned my back around for one moment. And I do. Okay, so there's a lot of, like, little things in the movie that I like, too. For example, they have, like, squids as floaties.
Yeah.
Like lifeguard floaties. I thought that was pretty cool. Okay. Like, that's a really nice little touch.
Yeah. This is a pretty fun movie. I am feeling a 7 out of 10 on this one, because the presentation and the performances really carry the film.
Yeah, I'd say I'm around like a 7 or like a 6.5, really. But I'd say I'd be a little generous with it and give it a 7. I think.
Okay.
Like, that's kind of around where I am, because. What it does well, it does really, really well. And I can't help but commend it for that.
Yeah, no. That was Surf's Up. And now we're going to talk about my recommendation.
You want to see a 180?
Yeah, holy
Get
shit.
Get ready for this film.
Holy shit. I'm actually a little excited to talk about this.
oh my God.
My recommendation for this episode was The Beach Bum, a 2019 film directed by Harmony Korine. And this film tells the story of a writer known by the moniker of Moondog. And in this film, he's just sort of, you know, mulling about Florida. But at one point, his wife dies, and... in order to collect his inheritance, he has to finish his book. So after he finds that out, he just sort of sets about living the life in Florida and writing and hanging around a bunch of weird people.
And smoking and fucking and...
Yeah, a lot of that.
Holy shit.
Yeah, no. So before we get into our thoughts, I messaged you when you mentioned you had finished the film. I asked you if this was the first Harmony Korine film you had seen. And it is, yes. I have seen all his movies at least twice, except for the new ones he's made when he started his own production company.
Oh, okay.
As of now, this has been his last big studio movie. Before this, he made Spring Breakers with James Franco and all the Disney girls. That James Franco was everyone was raving about James Franco's performance in Spring Breakers. One day we'll maybe talk about Spring Breakers. Anyways, this film, this was sort of his last big studio thing. We have a big fucking cast, fucking Matthew McConaughey, Snoop Dogg, Martin Lawrence, Zac Efron. So I'm very curious. Kara, what did you think of the beach bum?
Holy fuck. I spent an hour and a half of my life watching a man be a complete douchebag.
Yeah.
I spent so much, the thing is that it's not even an incredibly long movie, but it felt long. I'm like, this guy's such a fucking asshole. Oh my god. When it comes to a lot of the movies that I'm recommended, I try to go in as blind as possible, and I had no sort of inkling as to what this could possibly be, and I had no idea that I was just going to be watching, beach trailer trash for an hour and a fucking half. Holy shit!
Okay, this is going to be an interesting discussion, because I really like this movie, but the reason I really like this movie is it sort of reads as sort of a turning point in this director's filmography. It's reflective of him, of Harmony Korine, of his sort of ethos as a filmmaker and as an artist. 'Cause I mentioned, before this he made a film called Trash Humpers, which is bizarre, and no one saw it except for me. And then he made Spring Breakers, which was this, relatively speaking, it was a big hit. It made a decent amount of money at the box office against a modest, seven-figure budget.
Okay.
So, he, comparatively speaking, in his career, he's fucking rolling in money at this point. And the studios apparently just keep forgetting who they're dealing with.
Okay, and
they're just okay, here's more fucking money. You got a big cast, so do what you fucking want.
And this is what he does.
Yeah, this is what he does.
You know, I feel like if I actually had this context, I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more. Because I think going in blank, it was not a fun experience.
Okay.
At least for me, it was definitely a little strange. Eventually I went, okay, what makes this a comedy?
I think...
See, we agreed this whole time, and now we're just gonna... Yeah, we're gonna kill each other.
See, humor's subjective. Everyone finds different things funny. I think this film's... I get laughs out of this film. I think yes, Moondog's a dumb douche, but
yeah,
he's, to me, he just reads as Florida Man. He's just sort of...
He's got the Florida Man vibe, does.
He's just sort of hanging about, you know, everyone just sort of accepts that he's there. He's just chill.
Yeah, he's the guy.
Yeah, he's the guy. And, you know, he's also regarded as this, you know, genius fucking writer. And
but he's so trash. Like, I can see the humor in that. Like, this dude apparently is a prolific writer, but he's such a trashy human being.
Yeah.
Like, I suppose I can get a little bit of humor out of, for sure. It's okay. Just like, yeah, this dude is regarded as this amazing writer, but he's going around, like, doing crack off of hookers and, like...
I think he just mostly does pot, but, you know,
Oh, yeah. I think there was only, like, one time, once or twice in the movie where they did it, but it was mostly pot, yeah.
Yeah, no,
the Jamaican blend.
Yeah. Yeah, so... What I like about Harmony Korine as a director, his filmmaking style in particular, it's very guerrilla. It feels like Harmony Korine and his crew are just sort of mulling about. They're just shooting Matthew McConaughey.
being a fucking weirdo.
Being a fucking weirdo.
Yeah.
Which is, in part is what inspired this script. You know, Harmony Korine was just mulling about Florida, okay, hanging around with weird people, and he was just like, I'm gonna write a movie about, you know, all this weirdness in Florida.
And yeah, because, like, I suppose I can at least admire movies that touch on the weird parts of society.
Yeah, and
like, there are some fucking weird people out there in the world.
That's Harmony Korine to a T.
Oh, okay.
Like, you watch, like, you see a film like Gummo and you'll get it immediately. But
yeah, so eventually I suppose we should probably touch on his other movies and stuff, yes, like that, because I like, this at the very least has gotten me curious about his like, other works.
I will admit he's done better than this, but,
okay,
to me, by the end, I feel this film reads as Harmony Korine sort of just saying fuck it to, you know, studio money, all the big frills of filmmaking, and, like, I'm just gonna, you know, live my weird life, make my weird fucking movies.
Well, and I mean,
because Moondog gets his inheritance, he writes a Pulitzer Prize winning book.
Yeah.
And he just literally burns it all down.
Yeah.
Yeah, he destroys
just lights it all up.
Lights it all up, rides away on his little, you know, dinghy, and it's like, yeah, fuck yeah. Yeah.
No, to be honest, I'm starting to realize that another sort of, like, good side of this this podcast project that we're going to do is really seeing the sort of different perspectives on a single film.
Yes.
Because, like, for me, after watching it, I was like, what the fuck was that? But then it's just like hearing you talk and hear about, like, this other stuff that this guy has done, I'm like, oh, okay, it's all actually coming together. And I feel like it's one of those things where I'd probably explore it again after seeing some of his other works, because it makes sense when you consider the person, but on its own, I was like, I feel awful. Like, this is so trashy.
Yeah, no, it's I think moments like him just riding into his daughter's wedding on this old person's, you know, scooter and just chucking her to the side. And then in the background you see the old woman crawling about. I think the entirety of fucking Martin Lawrence talking about dolphins is comedy gold, at least to me.
Okay. Like, yeah.
Him calm down. I gotta feed my coke addicted parrot. Like, that's great. That's what makes this film so much fun. You could view it as just, you know, trashy, but there's a humor to how trashy these people are.
There's a humor in the trashiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that absolutely carries this film is Matthew McConaughey's performance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was born to be this character.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also shows just how good of an actor he is, because there's a couple moments in particular where he, you know, he isn't reacting how, you know, Matthew McConaughey would react to a particular situation. He is reacting how Moondog would react to a particular situation. Yeah. So, like, the moment during the reception for his daughter's wedding, and he spots his wife and Snoop Dogg when he finds out they're she's cheating on him, he's just sort of like, huh. Yeah, he's just sort of, huh. But subtly, you could see, like, his fucking heart shattered in that moment. But he's just sort of zonked out, and he's just, huh.
No, and I think...
like, he can't process that.
No.
And same thing when his wife died. Like, when that heart monitor goes flat, he's just sort of standing there like he accepts it. It's like, okay. But it's like, it's not processing properly. Like, it's...
yeah.
He's shattered inside, but he's just... sort of chill on the outside. And like, I like how Harmony Korine presents that character, like, you know, all the fucking, you know, trashy stoner stuff is just sort of him, after a certain point, it's just sort of him masking, you know, grief.
Yeah, because like, he may be like this chill stoner guy, but it doesn't make him impervious to pain.
Yeah, absolutely. And past that point, he's just sort of trying to rebuild and figure out what he's going to do. And while on this journey, he meets a bunch of weirdos. He meets Martin Lawrence on his, like, you know, decrepit fucking dolphin tour.
Yeah.
Which was fun. Him and a bunch of homeless people trash his wife's mansion, which lands him in rehab, and he meets
Zac Efron,
a fucking coked up douchebag.
Yeah, he's like a, what is it? He has a pyromaniac. There we go. That's the word I'm looking for. He's a pyromaniac.
Yes, and Zac Efron was entertaining. Fun fact about this, the way his beard and hair was styled, Harmony Korine one day just sort of looked at the grill lines on a panini, and he was just like, that would look funny on Zac Efron's face.
Okay, that's pretty great, actually. No, he's got that, do you remember the interviewer, or the, oh no, it's the games runner from Hunger Games, where he had that, yeah, it's got that same sort of stupid douchey look.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's, this film is just a bunch of, it's a fever dream experience of Matthew McConaughey hanging out with weirdos. Yeah. And for me, you know, that's what Harmony Korine's all about. And another thing I like about Harmony Korine's music is his taste in music. The soundtrack in this film is fun. It's reflective of the setting. There's like all this, you know, yacht rock and soft rock. Like, fucking Jimmy Buffett shows up in this film. Like, Moondog just sort of opens up one of his concerts with a poetry reading.
It's like an awful poem,
too. Yeah, no,
it's just so risque and awful.
Yeah, no, like, it just doesn't go over, and it's like, and he's just, all right, here's Jimmy Buffett.
Yeah, and he's just like,
just fucks, like, off.
Yeah. Like, it's,
I think another element to the film that sort of ties this idea of Harmony Korine sort of searching for his next sort of step as a filmmaker, is the film will cut to this grainy ass VHS footage of Moondog reciting, doing a lecture on, you know, what is poetry. I don't exactly remember the specifics of that speech, but I feel it vaguely, from my recollection, really, at least in terms of presentation, fit this arc, because at Harmony Korine's like first two films, Gummo, Julian Donkey Boy, are like shot on like dingy ass, you know, 16mm mini DV cameras.
Oh, okay.
So like, it felt to me like those particular moments were like him trying to remember who he was and reconnect with what made his movies special. Back to the soundtrack, though. You had the yacht rock and stuff, but he also threw in, you know, rap, because fucking Snoop Dogg's in this film. He's just being Snoop Dogg. There wasn't really much to it.
No.
But there was also great uses of, like, a bunch of alternative rock music, like The Cure uses a couple Cure songs. The scene where he sees his wife cheating on him is set to Just Like Heaven. I love that song. Fucking banger song. But it fit so well, because that particular song is about, you know, being sort of in love with someone and it being this sort of magical experience. Just to get into the cast, because we gotta, like, an eclectic cast. Like,
it's loaded.
Yeah,
it
fucking
is loaded.
Matthew McConaughey. We talked about his great performance. Snoop Dogg's just there being Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, and then you've got Jonah Hill. Yeah.
He was just as douchey as Matthew McConaughey, but more so. And he was really into it. Zac Efron was entertaining, like, uber douche in that role.
It's got to be at least a little bit therapeutic for some of these actors to just be like, I can be such a fucking asshole in this movie.
Yeah, no, they get to do, like, weird stuff, just weird fucking things. You know, break loose from all the Hollywood, like, normal movies they do and just do a fucking weird ass Harmony Korine film. And that's, like, just, it's nice to do that as an artist. Just break away from normal things and just do weird shit.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's why I think Harmony Korine, part of why Harmony Korine is one of my favorite directors, is because it doesn't matter if his budget is, like, you know, ham sandwich levels or like a proper studio movie. Everything he makes is him. It's his voice. Like, there's barely any compromise to it. It's quintessentially him throughout it all. And, you know, and that can be, you know, a hard pill to swallow for some. Not everyone likes Harmony Korine, you know. But for me, you know, I want filmmakers to just do weird things, be them, take risks, because that makes it more fun.
It really does, you know. You got to commend a director for doing stuff like that, even if it doesn't jive completely with you, or even if it's just not perfect, because it's just their unaltered image. I mean, it reminds me of the Jim Henson Company. Actually, they have essentially put their foot down and said that they are not going to be giving the rights to the Dark Crystal to anyone unless they completely agree with their father's image, essentially. Right. They want it to be made exactly how Jim Henson would have made it. And I think that's incredible, you know?
Yeah.
And especially now where, and I suppose we'll probably, like, this is especially a problem even with, like, animated movies and things like that. It's just, like, the studio's getting involved, and then something that could have been really exceptional is just brought down by just this, like, oh, we got to do this because that's what audiences would want. And it's like, but it brings down the film and it ultimately hurts the message and the art, and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want artists to be themselves, make what they want to make, and doesn't matter if it's a fucking dingy ass, you know, $2,000 movie like fucking Primer, which Shane Carruth made, or a film like, you know, Gummo or Julian Donkey Boy.
Hundreds of Beavers.
Hundreds of Beavers. Just make cool shit and don't be bogged down in, you know, what sells or what fucking producers or studios want. Because, you know, if it's good, it'll find an audience.
I mean, for goodness sake, look at our prestigious man, Neil Breen.
Yeah,
he's just doing what he loves and has an audience. You know,
yeah,
like, they're awful movies, but damn, they're just, like, they're entertaining in their how genuine that they are.
He's...
You know, like, you can't help but like them and how passionate he is for these films as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like
he makes what he wants.
Yeah, he makes what he wants.
Good for him. So yeah, no, this was a fun discussion.
It was. At least at some point we butted heads on something, I suppose.
No,
before
it was bound to happen.
It's bound to happen.
We spent four movies, vehemently agreeing with each other.
It's just like, oh fuck, here we go.
I really like The Beach Bum. I think it lands in an interesting place in this man's filmography. And I think Matthew McConaughey gives a hell of a performance in this film. And this film in general is just Harmony Korine. And I can't get enough of Harmony Korine. It was in my top 10 of 2019 for a little while. But after rewatching it, it got bumped out of it. It's still top 15, I think, or top 20, maybe. But I like it. I really like it, and I'm feeling an 8.5 out of 10 on this one.
For me, I believe for now it's probably a 5 for me.
Okay.
But I think I am actually willing to, after watching some more of this man's movies, coming back to this one, based on the things that you've said. And if I had had that perspective going in, it probably would have been a different type of viewing, I think.
Okay.
But I think in the future, that's definitely a visit back to. But for now, it's just not my, I gotta say, it's not my cup of tea. So
fair
probably
enough.
A 5 for me.
Fair enough. That's good stuff. I think that about wraps it for this episode. That's it. Follow us on social media. We are, all our social media is at Talking in Two Dimensions. Episodes will be out, once a month at the end of the month. And yeah, you can give us a follow on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Premium, wherever you get your podcasts. So yeah, for everyone here, I'm Phoenix.
And I'm Karen.
And until next time, have a happy beach bum. Yeah.